Hi, welcome to part two of education in our study of the introduction to sociology. In developing countries, the number and seriousness of the problems in education is greater. People are sometimes unaware of the importance of education, and there's economic pressure from those parents who prioritize their children making money in the short term over any long-term benefits of education. So you might have children or teens who are put to work at something that makes very little money, but at least it makes something, but they then never get any opportunity for formal education, which might greatly increase their earning power. And so it's challenging sometimes for families to give their children the opportunity to get the education that would benefit them. Recent studies on child labor and poverty have suggested, however, that when poor families reach a certain economic threshold where families are able to provide for their basic needs, parents return their children to school. Teachers are often paid less than other similar professions. So there's a challenge not only of children that are kept home rather than sent to school in order to earn just a little more money, but also underpaid teachers. And it's not always because the parents don't care at all about education. That might be a problem in some situations. But many parents would like their children to be schooled and will do so if they have the minimum to get by in life financially. A lack of good universities and a low acceptance rate for good universities is evident in countries with a relatively high population density. In some countries, there are uniform, overstructured, inflexible, centralized programs from a central agency that regulates all aspects of education. So sometimes there's just not enough good universities available and enough slots for people to get accepted into, and sometimes government bureaucracy and educational bureaucracy is so overdone that it makes it very hard for people to seize opportunities. Technology has become an increasingly influential factor in education. Computers and associated technology are being widely used. Well, you know that. You're on your computer or your smartphone or other device right now. They're being widely used in developed countries to both complement established education practices and to develop new ways of learning, such as online education, which is a type of distance education. So developed countries, it's important, but also in countries that are still developing. What are the functions of education? Well, transmission of knowledge. There's just a lot of stuff, facts, truths that need to be brought from one generation to another. There's socialization, the use of social setting to shape the character and the behavior and the sense of what matters in the next generation. There's social integration. Sometimes education is used to help immigrants become part of a society, or used by immigrant cultures to help them not to become too much a part of that society and to retain their own identity. But a purpose or goal of education is to put it more simply, help people fit in. Social integration means helping people fit in, and sometimes people shouldn't fit in. Don't be conformed to the bad things of this world. And sometimes people do need to feel more at ease in a culture and know how that culture operates so that they can succeed in it. Education can serve cultural innovation. There are sometimes new discoveries and new ways of doing things that are very helpful, and they're not picked up in the traditional setting, but schools or other educational methods can help innovate. And here's another one, child care for workers. People got to go to work during the day. What are they going to do with the kids? Hey, send them to school. That'll get rid of them for a while. Doesn't sound too noble, but that is one major function of schools. And a lot of parents are left scratching their heads. What do I do with my kids when school is not in session? By the way, that's also a reason for the existence of kindergarten and pre-kindergarten and pre-pre-kindergarten and preschool and school from almost the day of birth. It's not that those two-year-olds desperately need formal education. It is that their parents work and their kids need to be somewhere. So child care for workers is one function, among others, of formal educational settings for children. Let's look at the relationship between education and gender according to social research, as well as the particular angle on social research that's taken by the textbook author. A recent topic of policy debate in the United States is the concern that there's a boy crisis, as boys are less likely to graduate from high school and go to college than are girls. However, recent research by Judith Kleinfeld suggests that painting this as a crisis exclusive to boys may be a little misleading. Boys do have problems: lower rates of literacy, lower grades, lower engagement in school, higher dropout rates, higher rates of placement in special education, higher rates of emotional disturbance, higher rates of learning disability, higher rates of suspension and expulsion from school, and lower rates of entrance into college. That's not a very nice list. So those are some pretty serious problems that boys have to a higher degree in many cases than girls do with school. Outside of school, boys are also more likely to commit suicide, exhibit conduct disorders, die young, and be arrested or sent to juvenile detention centers. Clearly, boys have a number of problems. Yeah, that's true enough. However, girls have their own share of problems that are no less serious than those facing young men, just different. Higher rates of depression, higher incidence of eating disorders, higher rates of suicide attempts. Boys commit suicide more often, but girls try it more often. The boys either are more serious or better at it. Lower scores on math and science tests for girls, and they're less likely to be the highest achievers. The highest achievers still tend to be the boys, although girls overall do better than boys. The best boys seem to achieve more highly than the best girls on average. So you have a set of problems that boys have in this realm of education a little more than girls do, and you have problems that girls tend to have more than boys do. Are the boys' problems more serious? Kleinfeld does conclude that the issues facing boys are probably more serious. For example, 25% of American male high school graduates can't understand a newspaper article versus only 10% of females. But she also reminds us that women are facing many serious issues as well. Now, there's been a reversal in who earns college degrees. In the United States in 1960, 65% of all bachelor's degrees went to men. In 1982, it reached parity between men and women. They were equal. In 2004, women received 58% of bachelor's degrees, and it's increased even more since then. So the 1960s and 1970s were pivotal years in which the reversal of educational disparity occurred between men and women. It used to be men got more college education, now far more women get college educated than men do. So there's a big reversal, and sociologists are very interested in what happened and wondering why. Here's some possible reasons. Higher dropout rates of men, especially if fathers are absent or fathers don't have college. So men don't graduate as often as women do because they drop out, and that's especially true in situations where there's no father around or where the father didn't value education. Earlier academic success for girls in junior high and high school means that they're getting better grades, they're getting rewarded for doing well in junior high, they're doing well in high school, so they feel better about education. Not only that, they've just learned better during that setting. Then that raises the question, well, are junior highs and high schools catering more to the style of learning that suits girls better than boys? That's the kind of question that sociologists have to raise if they see that girls are doing better than boys at the lower level, and that it continues at the higher level where they're also graduating from college more. There's also a faster rise in the value of college for females than for males. And part of this might be simply the disparity of physical strength between men and women. There are certain occupations that men get into that women largely avoid. And they may involve construction, things that require a lot of physical strength, or just things that maybe men tend to prefer doing. And you don't need a college degree to do all of those. So, on the other hand, the knowledge economy has given many jobs that involve not so much physical strength, but just the ability to sit still, to focus, to concentrate, to use your mind. And so women who learn to do that well can make a great living, as well as men who do that well can make a great living, sometimes more than men who use their physical strength. But at any rate, this rise in the value of college, as the knowledge economy has grown, it's become more profitable to be college educated, and that's meant that women can earn greater dollars by getting a college education. And another reason for the reversal in women getting college degrees more than men is the rising divorce rates, and that forces women to be more independent. They need that college degree in order to earn a good living. So these may be some of the factors for the reversal. It's also had an impact on marriage, as more women in comparison to men have gotten college degrees. The increase in completion rate of women may have substantial influences on society in general, as education and income are important factors when considering who one will marry. And here's just a fact of the way things are. More women stay single rather than marry a less educated, lower income man. Explain it however we wish. Many women want to marry up, so to speak. I won't go into it, but this is what it's saying about the impact on marriage. As women get more educated, they become less likely to marry a man who's not as educated. How about the relationship between education and income? A major factor contributing to educational inequality and poverty in the U.S. is the funding system for public education. In most areas, public schools are funded through local property taxes, and as a result, schools in wealthier neighborhoods have larger budgets, and that translates into better facilities, better teachers, better resources. And so the disparity in education in the United States is often who can afford to buy into the rich neighborhoods, which also happen to have the best schools. And if you don't have much money and you have to live in a poor neighborhood, you may also have a rotten school with poorly funded buildings and teachers who maybe have a harder time getting hired at somewhere else. There are also some great teachers in poor neighborhoods who are doing it out of a vision and a desire to teach and make a difference there. I'm not denying that. But overall, a higher quality education often comes with a higher quality neighborhood, and a higher quality neighborhood in terms of its income. So income disparity can often lead to education inequality as well. When these monetary advantages are coupled with the advantage of having a safe, supportive, and intellectually enriching home environment that comes with wealth, it's not surprising that children who attend better funded schools tend to be more successful than those who attend more poorly funded public schools. Just pick on a phrase there a moment. It says that a good home environment comes with wealth. Not necessarily. What if wealth tends to come with a good home environment? Very often, if marriages remain intact, that is one of the keys to building household wealth. So just want to point that out. It's not, oh, we have a lot of money, so that makes our household stable and intellectually enriching. Sometimes it's because you had the stable household and the stable family that it also tended to prosper financially. Here's another phenomenon, tracking, which contributes to inequality. In U.S. schools, tracking is commonly employed, and tracking is separating students into different classes based on their abilities and skills. So you have one kind of class for students who don't seem to learn as quickly. You have another class for those who seem to be specially gifted. Another class for those who seem to be in the middle. And when you start that early on, then kids who are identified as gifted get better and better education, and kids who are identified as deficient, maybe even if they're not so deficient, tend to fall further and further behind in terms of their overall abilities and intellectual achievements. So tracking increases disparity in educational attainment rather than reducing the inequalities. What about the relationship between education and family? Evidence suggests that the lifetime educational possibilities of most kids are set by the time they're 6 years old. Wow. This is due to the fact that several family background characteristics are very strong predictors of future educational attainment, including parental support, parental expectations for schooling, household income, and parental educational attainment, with the last two being the most important factors. So parents have a huge role in how well children are going to be educated, and in fact, you can predict by the time a kid is six, you can predict more from what you know about their parents than from what you know about the kid in terms of how they're going to end up succeeding in school and succeeding in their earning power. So that might be discouraging for some people in some situations, but it certainly ought to encourage those of us who are parents to do our level best to support our children in their education and in their training and in learning to work hard and to work well. Education and family can't be separated. Also surprising in this study was the finding that the lifetime educational attainment predicted using background characteristics when individuals were in the first grade were just as good at predicting educational attainment as were similar variables when individuals were in high school, and on some measures, better. So if you knew about a kid's family in first grade, you could tell as much or more about them than if you studied the child himself in high school. That's quite a testament to how big a role family plays in education, even when kids spend a lot of their time in school. In real terms, this translates into children living in poorer neighborhoods receiving less education than children who live in middle-class or upper-class neighborhoods. What's more, the lifetime educational attainment seems to be set by the time children are starting school, not when they're finishing it. Again, this is not true of every individual. These are generalizations. That's what sociology does. It generalizes. It tells you what happens more and what happens less, not what happens always and what happens never. But as a general rule, where you have strong family and more prosperous neighborhood, then the education is going to be stronger. Where you have weak family structure and poorer neighborhood, the education is at a great disadvantage. And part of the reason for that, as we observed earlier, is that also that government funding comes through property taxes, and the property taxes are way higher in the rich neighborhoods, and so the schools get paid for much better. So there's a variety of factors: how well the schools are funded, the way taxes are structured, but inescapably, family, and whether family values education and whether family is stable has a huge impact. Who attends college? Well, educational deficits resulting from inequality also affect future life trajectories. Colleges tend to draw students from a relatively advantaged background because of their high costs and because of their stiff academic requirements for getting enrolled in the first place. You've got to have some money to pay for college, and you have to have good grades to get in. If you're poor, or if you got weak grades, it's hard to get into college, and you're at a great disadvantage. Just a quick story. A person who has taught at CLI grew up in a broken family. A parent was an alcoholic. He went to 13 different schools in 12 years. When he graduated high school, he could not read. That's his situation. And he became a Christian. And he decided he wanted to be able to read the Bible. And he learned to read, and he learned to read more and more. And he ended up getting his doctorate, his PhD, and became a college and university professor. So again, don't ever let sociology rule your destiny. When you're an individual, you can learn some of these things, but don't say, oh, this is an excuse for why I'm never going to be able to achieve anything. If you have those disadvantages, be realistic. They are disadvantages. And then say, but if I rely on the Lord, if I walk with Him, if I count on His abilities that He's given me to flourish, perhaps I can be a lot more than my home situation or my neighborhood or my schools ever gave me the opportunity for. At any rate, college and education in general have a tight link with finance and a tight link with family. What's more, because colleges want to maintain their rankings in various college ranking systems, colleges favor students with higher standardized test scores and recruit them using merit scholarships. Well, of course, colleges want to get the smart kids. They want to get the kids who know the most. And those kids will go on to be alumni who donate to the college. And so for their own economic well-being, they want them to be high earners. So they're going to be biased in favor of the people who they think are going to be able to pay their tuition while they're there and make donations after they graduate. Affluent students receive merit scholarships worth 82% of the need-based aid received by students with the lowest family incomes. So financial aid is really meant to help people who don't have much money, but a lot of it ends up going to help people who hardly even need it, but have good grades. So again, sociologists can point some of these things out, and we need to be aware of them, and in some cases need to address them. In other words, affluent students who could pay for college often don't have to, because the advantages they received attending better elementary, better middle schools, better high schools, translated into higher standardized test scores, which are attractive to universities when it comes to recruiting. As a result, there's less funding available for students who actually need it. And this ends up reinforcing the existing status hierarchy by keeping the affluent wealthy and keeping the poor unable to attend college and keeping them poor. Some of those underprivileged youth choose another path as a result. Despite being both volunteer and high risk, the military remains attractive to a certain segment of the U.S. population, primarily young people from less advantaged families and neighborhoods. They view the military as more promising than entry-level jobs without a college diploma. Youth from disadvantaged homes are about average cognitively, but are socioeconomically disadvantaged. So they may be about as smart as anybody else, about average for smarts, but they have other disadvantages, and that's one of the reasons that they turn to the military rather than to college to pursue financial success. And they succeed in it to some degree. Many kids who started out and didn't flourish within the school system sometimes do very well in the military, prove themselves to be very capable and qualified in a lot of different areas, and succeed very well in life. And again, not all people who go into the military do so just because of their poverty or because they want to deal with that kind of situation. Some of them really want to serve their country, want to defend what is right and just as they believe their country does, and so they'll serve for those reasons as well. What about the relationship of education to health and long life? Education is a strong and significant predictor of greater life expectancy. The more years of education a person has, the greater their likelihood of engaging in healthy behaviors, and, on the other hand, the lower their likelihood of engaging in unhealthy behaviors like smoking. So some forms of education just teach you, hey, here's how to eat well, here's what to avoid that's bad for your health, and not surprisingly, those who have better training live a healthier lifestyle than those who have less training. Charter schools, what are they? Well, charter schools are publicly funded elementary or secondary schools in the United States. So they're funded still by the government, but they've been freed from some of the rules, regulations, and statutes that apply to other public schools in exchange for some type of accountability for producing certain results which are set forth in each school's charter. So the charter school says, we're going to do things a little differently, and we're not going to have quite as much regulation by the government, but we're going to be accountable to the government for this, this, and this outcome that we're promising. And so they may say, we're going to go into a poorer community, and we're going to establish a charter school there, and our children that we educate are going to achieve these levels. And if we don't, we fail our charter. And the government may hold them accountable to that. But they're different in many ways than just standard public schools. Their founders are often teachers, parents, or activists who feel restricted by traditional public schools. State-run charter schools, schools not affiliated with local school districts, are often established by nonprofit groups, universities, and some government entities. Now, high school completion rates in the U.S. are often lower than reported. How many people actually finish high school? Well, you get different sets of numbers. The percentage of students who graduate from high school, often reported by the federal government in the U.S., is around 85%, but a more accurate percentage is about 71%. About one-fourth of young people in America today are moving into adulthood without a high school diploma, and for some, that's a significant disadvantage. Lack of a high school diploma contributes to lower wages and increased rates of poverty, as well as poorer general understandings of society and health and science. The U.S. is 16th of 27 industrialized nations in high school completion rates. Almost one-third of U.S. students don't have the minimum education to contribute to a globalized high-tech economy. And again, sometimes that may sound worse than it is. Not everybody's going to be in a high-tech job. Not everybody likes high-tech work. But if you don't even have the opportunity for education in the first place, that does place you at a disadvantage, especially if some of those are the best paid jobs. The goal of education is the transference of ideas and skills from one person to another and from one person to a group or from one group or one generation to the next generation. And current education issues include which teaching methods are most effective, how to determine what knowledge should be taught. You know, what should you teach? Should you teach all children how to make a nuclear weapon? Should you teach all children how to mix poisons? Should you teach all children God created the heavens and the earth? You know, what should be taught? Should you teach them 3 plus 5 equals 8? You have to determine what knowledge should be taught, what's most relevant. You know, there may be things that the kings of England did back in the 1100s. How important is that for kids to know today? Maybe you say it's really important because we can learn from other cultures and other eras. But educators have to decide, what do I not teach? Because you can't teach everything. And then what do I do? What should I teach? What kind of knowledge is plain bad in the area of sex education? Do you teach a bunch of 12-year-olds all the details of condoms and sexuality and so on? Some people say, well, yes, of course. We don't want a bunch of people getting sexually transmitted diseases or getting pregnant. And yet there may be other research that shows that the existence of such classes actually increases the amount of premarital sexual activity and the amount of sexually transmitted diseases. So the very teaching of it may have an impact of itself. And so educators have to think about what's most relevant, what should be taught, what are effective ways of teaching it, and how do you teach it so the kids remember it? You know, you can teach them something, they pass the quiz, and then it's out of their mind within a day or two. So educators have to think about what's most important to teach, how do I help them remember it? Educators such as George Counts and Paulo Freire identified education as an inherently political process with inherently political outcomes. Well, that's certainly true when government-run education has become the predominant form of education. If government is running things, then of course it's an inherently political outcome. The challenge of identifying whose ideas are transferred and what goals they serve has always stood in the face of formal and informal education. Do you teach children that Jesus Christ is the one in whom all things hold together? Or do you teach as though God doesn't even exist and that you can learn all the important things of life without even mentioning God? Those are two very, very different approaches to education. Education is inherently religious. Education is inherently political in many respects. In addition to the three R's, reading, writing, and arithmetic, Western schools try to teach the basic knowledge of history, geography, mathematics, physics, chemistry, and sometimes politics, in the hopes that students will retain and use this knowledge as they age, or that the skills they acquire will be transferable. You know, they learn some things in math, and they may not have to do all that math stuff in their job, but at least be able to transfer to figure some things out when they get into the workforce. So what do you teach? And every educator has to think really hard about that. And how do you measure things? The current education system measures competency with tests and assignments and then assigns each student a corresponding grade. The grades usually come in the form of either a letter grade or a percentage, which are intended to represent the amount of material presented in class that the student understood. Even here at CLI, we give grades. And to be honest, I don't care about grades except to the degree that they indicate that you learned the material. But some students can get really focused on, did I get an A? Oh, did I get an A? Oh, I only got an A minus. Or did I get a C plus? Oh, all is lost. Your aim is to know God better, to become more godly, to shape other lives. And so the grade you get may be an indicator of how well you're learning certain things, but it's mainly an incentive and to help with accountability. And so it is with the rest of life. Getting great grades is not the only thing there is to education. Grades are there to give students an incentive, to give teachers a way of measuring, but sometimes the measuring isn't very accurate, and sometimes students who get poorer grades go on to be outstanding and successful in various pursuits in life. Educational progressives, or advocates of unschooling, who don't like formal schooling very much, often believe that grades do not necessarily reveal the strengths and weaknesses of a student, and that there is an unfortunate lack of youth voice in the educative process. Again, that can be a little humorous. If we had a full youth voice, the youth might say, we don't want to go to class at all. We would like to eat ice cream and play video games all day. So parents can't just do whatever the youth want, and teachers can't do just whatever the youth want. But on the other hand, we also have to realize that a system and grades aren't everything. They may have some value and importance, but they're sure not everything. Some feel the current grading system risks lowering students' self-confidence, as students may receive poor marks due to factors outside their control. Such factors include poverty, child abuse, and prejudiced or incompetent teachers. And if you grow up for 12 or more years of schooling where you get bad grades or people say you're dumb, you start believing that. I remember when I was an intern, not quite yet a pastor, but serving as a helper to a pastor in a church, a young man, a little older than I, came over for supper one time, and Wendy and I had him for supper, and Andy said to me, Dave, you are so smart, and I am so stupid. Because, you see, he had gone through school and he'd gotten bad grades. And who was he now? Well, actually, he was a guy who worked in a factory, and he was had contributed many ideas for design on cars and for the robots that make them, and was making a huge income while he was doing it. And the reason he was over at my house eating supper was he was there to fix my car, which I didn't know how to fix. So here's a guy telling a dunce like me, who can't do anything with a car, how smart I am and how dumb he is, when in fact he was there because he knew what I didn't know. But he had been through a school where he got bad grades and got the impression that he was dumb, and he knew I had gotten good grades in school and I could talk a lot, so I was smart. That's one of the dangers of grades, is there are only one way of measuring one kind of learning. And there are some people who have different kinds of learning and great abilities who didn't get the good grades. And unfortunately, for people like me, there are people who got great grades who are really rotten at some things and can't do them at all. Well, in contrast to those who say we should just forget about grades, and I'm not sure we should forget about them entirely, but there are many advocates of a more traditional or back-to-basics approach, and they believe that the direction of reform needs to be the opposite of saying, oh, let's have unschooling and no grades. They want it more structured. Students aren't sufficiently inspired or challenged to achieve success because of the dumbing down of the curriculum and the replacement of the canon or the expected subjects with inferior material. You know, some educators say, well, we want all the kids to feel good about themselves, so let's just make it all easy. Or let's just make it on subjects that have nothing to do with what is really important, but stuff they'll just have a little fun with. Well, is that really helping them? The view of the back-to-basics people is that self-confidence comes not from removing hurdles such as grading, but by making the grading fair and encouraging students to gain pride from knowing they can jump over these hurdles. So the self-confidence comes not from removing all learning or all grades, but from actually achieving something. And there's truth in both approaches, that sometimes grades are emphasized too much, but on the other hand, kids sometimes have to be challenged, and they have to achieve things that they didn't think they could. And the back-to-basics approach emphasizes that. Well, I want to focus on the real back-to-basics as I end this portion of my talk. What are the real basics of education? The basic teacher is parents. Even sociology demonstrates that if your formal education occurs in schools, the best predictor of what you achieve in education is still going to be what your family was like. And of course, there are some families who educate without formal schooling at all and who do homeschooling and whose children do very well. But the Bible makes it very clear that fathers and mothers are the primary educators of their children. And We who are parents have a responsibility to make sure that they come to know God, that they know the Bible, that they know right and wrong, that they know how to fight the evil one, and yes, that they know mathematics and science and history and literature and all the other aspects of this amazing world that God has put us in. But the basic teacher is the parents. And don't think you can just send your kids off to school and not be at all involved in their education. You are their main educator if you're a father or a mother. What's the basic attitude of education? Love. You say, oh man, that's kind of a warm, fuzzy, squishy, squashy kind of thing when it comes to education. But think about it. Where does education flourish the best? When it travels across the bridge of love. And that's exactly why parents are the most basic teacher. Where children know they are loved, they learn better than when their spirit is always so troubled that their mind can't learn as well because they're not secure in being loved. When children love their parents and their parents love their children, when they're being taught by teachers who love kids and who care about them, there's a huge difference between teachers who are there for the paycheck only and teachers who, yeah, they earn their living out of it, but they love kids. And they love the subject they're teaching. And don't forget also, love for God. To know that you're loved by God, that you love Him, that you love the world He's made. What a powerful energy that gives you to learn more about that world, to learn more about the God who made it, and to do it in the context of people who love you and want to help you learn. So, again, it's not bad sociology or just being warm and fuzzy to say love matters to education. Education thrives in a context of love, and it withers in a context where love is absent. What's the basic book of education? The Bible. The Bible is, of course, the best-selling book of all time. The Bible is the most important book to learn, even if you're not a Christian. You're not educated if you don't know what's in the Bible. Hey, when they teach English in Japan, and when they teach English literature, the first thing they require is that students learn something of the Bible, because they know what the foundational book of English-speaking culture is, even if some English-speaking people try to pretend it's not so, and some English-speaking schools, in the name of being religiously neutral, say nothing about the most important book that exists. The basic book of education is the Bible. Hey, you're at Christian Leaders Institute. I don't need to belabor that point. But when it comes to teaching your children, when it comes to the kind of setting that they're in for their learning, and what you encourage others as a Christian leader to seek in the education of their children, the Bible is the basic book. What's the basic classroom? Well, here the unschoolers have a point. Everywhere. Even if you take school in a formal setting, even if you take classes, even if your children go to classes, what they learn outside class is also hugely important. Everything we do, we're gaining something from experience. It may be gaining something bad, or gaining something good and positive and healthy, but we need to be alert and learn whatever we go. That's why the Bible says, talk about these things when you walk along the road, when you lie down, when you get up. God's thoughts are to be everywhere you go, interpreting everything you look at. And getting back to the Bible as your basic book. John Calvin said the Bible is like glasses or spectacles. It helps you not just to see what's in it, but to look through it and then to see everything else more clearly. So when you've got the Bible in your mind and the Lord in your heart, then everywhere you go, you're learning things from the Lord. And what's the basic goal of all education? A God-based life. A life built not on sand, but on the solid rock of Jesus Christ. And here, secular sociology just can't help us. It can't tell us what the real foundation of life is, or the real basis of all healthy education is, but we know it from Jesus Himself. Everyone who hears His words and puts them into practice is building on the rock.